From NPR News, this is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Who wants to be the next Ronald Reagan? Well, last night's Republican debate, held at the Ronald Reagan Library in Simi Valley, was a free-for-all for the quest to define who's a true conservative. Just listen to Mitt Romney go at Senator John McCain.
I guess I'd also note that if you get endorsed by the New York Times, you're probably not a conservative.
Senator McCain?
Let me note that I was endorsed by your two hometown newspapers who know you best, including the very conservative Boston Herald, who know you well, better than anybody. So I'll guarantee you the Arizona Republic will be endorsing me, my friend.
Here to offer their take on last night's showdown are political strategist Damal Simmons and Angela McLaughlin. Angela is an analyst for Fox News and author of the best-selling book Bamboozled, How Americans Are Being Exploited by the Lies of the Liberal Agenda. And Damal was press secretary for the presidential campaigns of both Senator Bob Graham and General Wesley Clark. Welcome to you both, and let me jump right into this. Simi Valley, California, isn't just home to the Reagan Library. It's also the place where an all-white jury acquitted officers in the beating of Rodney King. I think we remember that. So what's the symbolism, Angela, behind holding the debate there?
The symbolism has nothing to do with Rodney King. It was the fact that you have a division in the Republican Party. Certain conservatives are not so crazy about John McCain, but certain evangelicals are not that crazy about Mitt Romney and being a Mormon. You have the evangelicals that are supporting Mike Huckabee. But one president that held it all together, from being fiscally responsible to international issues to bringing down the Cold War, and that is Ronald Reagan. So any candidate that can closely align himself to Ronald Reagan more than likely will bring the party together. And as it looks like right now, John McCain is that guy.
Jamal, there's an expression that some people have used called getting your fanny tanned. And people tried to do that to Senator Barack Obama when he invoked the legacy of Ronald Reagan as one which reverberated. And, you know, people spun it as, did he believe in Reagan's message? But certainly Ronald Reagan was, as the saying goes, a great communicator. So why is this legacy so important to the Republicans in this specific case?
Well, I think everyone in the country, history and memory have a way of looking back fondly over times that were a little bit rough for a lot of people. And Ronald Reagan, while I think Senator Obama was trying to make the point that Ronald Reagan was a profound man in the sense that he moved the debate in the direction that he wanted to go. He got people in the American country behind him to go in that direction. And even a lot of people who didn't agree with him still liked him a lot and they moved in that direction. The problem is the direction he took the country was actually not a good direction. And I don't think Senator Obama was trying to imply that it was a good direction or that he was in favor of it, but just that Reagan had some phenomenal skills and was able to move the debate. So for most Democrats, when you talk about Ronald Reagan, it's sort of mixed. He gets some credit for standing up on national security policy. But if you lived in a city like where I'm from in Detroit, you saw the city decimated by a loss of funds to cities and housing and education and economic policies that really favored the rich over the middle class, working people and the poor.
But something that I would like to add, even Ronald Reagan had Charlie Rangel at the White House, and he brought Charlie Rangel and Bob Packwood and Bob Dole together on the war on drugs, especially when crack was taking over Detroit and Chicago and Harlem. So even though certain communities are not very happy with some of the things that Ronald Reagan did, what Obama was saying in essence, that this is a president that could bring Democrats and Republicans together on issues that impact all Americans.
I want to break it down a little bit as to who the key players are. It seems as if we saw, for example, former Senator John Edwards drop out of the Democratic race. It seems as if the Republican race may be tightening to a two-man race between John McCain and Mitt Romney. Now, McCain came into this debate just 24 hours after a big win in Florida and an endorsement from Rudy Giuliani, who also dropped out. Did he continue his momentum, do you think, Jamal, going into the debate?
Oh, I think that John McCain is certainly in the pole position here, as they say, in racing. He's the person setting the pace for everyone else. And Mitt Romney's got to find a way to catch up. I think the Schwarzenegger endorsement today is going to be big for John McCain. And the real issue here, I think, why people are going for John McCain, and in some sense, it also explains why Barack Obama is having the boom that he's having over the last couple of weeks. I think Americans are really looking for someone who they can trust and who they'll know that they're going to do tomorrow what they said they were going to do today. And Mitt Romney is an attractive candidate, but you just don't know where this guy's going to come down on issues. He's been a liberal Republican. He's been a moderate Republican. Now he's a conservative Republican. And so when the political winds shift tomorrow, no one knows which way he'll blow.
Angela, let me actually direct you towards a very specific issue that may get you to this point.
Okay.
You know, McCain and Mitt Romney were talking about Romney's record on the Iraq War.
Yes.
McCain claims Romney has set a timetable for getting out of Iraq. Let's listen to Romney's response.
Every single debate that I've attended, 15 debates, I do not propose, nor have I ever proposed, a public or secret date for withdrawal. It is simply wrong. And by the way, raising it a few days before the Florida primary, when there was very little time for me to correct the record, when the question I was most frequently asked is, oh, you're for a specific date of withdrawal, sort of falls in the kind of dirty tricks that I think Ronald Reagan would have found to be reprehensible.
Once again, Ronald Reagan invoked.
Right.
Was this a question of lies, dirty tricks, just plain elbow-to-elbow politicking? What was going on
here? Well, it depends on what soundbite you use, because apparently when Mitt Romney made that type of statement, he explained that he was not for setting a particular timetable. But let's look back at Florida. Right before the Florida primary, people were getting ready to vote. Mitt Romney was very strong on the economy, seemingly. He was polling well on the economy, and John McCain was polling very well on national security. So maybe the John McCain handlers thought the strategy would be make Mitt Romney look weak on national security. And in essence, Floridians voted for John McCain on the economy as well. So I think it was pretty dirty politics, but I think that Mitt Romney came out on top, and that you even had Sean Hannity interviewing Lindsey Graham, who's a big McCain supporter, saying in essence that Mitt Romney didn't say what John McCain said he said. But at the end of the day, with Rudolph Giuliani endorsing McCain, I thought that was great. But what would really put McCain over the top is if Mike Huckabee endorses him. That will bring more of the conservatives to John McCain's side.
Jamal, one of the things we talk about a lot here on News and Notes is the prevailing winds of African-American sentiment going towards the Democrats. And so you haven't seen a lot of campaigning by Republican candidates like McCain, like Romney, like Huckabee in African-American neighborhoods. But, you know, maybe step out of your comfort zone a little bit here. What do you see in these guys that might resonate with African-American voters in traditionally African-American communities?
Well, the only place where I'll disagree with you is I think the Mike Huckabee has made some effort with the African-American community. He did show up at one of the debates that was targeted at African-Americans. He did show up at the Martin Luther King celebration in Atlanta last week, a couple of weeks ago. So I do think that Mike Huckabee has, and African-Americans I know in Arkansas say that he was pretty popular receiving 40-plus percent of the vote down there. So on that score, it's a little bit different. What I would say for the others, though, particularly John McCain, you know, African-Americans sometimes can be, you know, we're fairly socially conservative. And I think that there's a case you could make to African-Americans on socially conservative issues around choice or around some of the other, the breakdown in family values, those issues that exist. And if you come to African-Americans, you talk about that, you talk about economic empowerment, and, you know, some of my best friends are Republicans, so we talk about this. You talk about economic empowerment, you talk about the breakdown of the family, I think that you have a receptive audience. The problem comes, though, when something happens like Katrina or with Rudy Giuliani, when something happens like, you know, a police brutality case, and then they side with the police. The African-Americans at heart just don't trust Republicans to be there for them when the going gets tough.
Angela, when you look at Mike Huckabee, is he someone who could A, try to reach out to other communities besides the traditional Republican base, and B, is he a goner, a has-been? I mean, is this really now a two-man race?
I don't think that he's a has-been, in essence. I think he's really going to help the Republican Party. And I think that Jamal was right that he has done well in the African-American community, and I think he's a secret weapon. But if you go back to the race of 2004, Bush got 16% of the black vote in Ohio because Karl Rove and Ken Mellman went into the black churches and talked about faith-based initiatives talked about pro-life issues and the sanctity of marriage. And you had black ministers from the pulpit saying it's time for us to vote our conscience, not culture or color. So I think that Huckabee could be a secret weapon to help the Republican Party reach out to that community. I thought that it was a mistake that the Republicans did not show up to Tavis Smiley's debate that he proposed on September 29th of last year. And I think that we have a grand opportunity in reaching out to our community. But sometimes it's just showing up.
Now, Jamal, what about the endorsement game? McCain picked up an endorsement today from California Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger. How big is that news? Is it going to influence things in Cali or beyond?
What's interesting is I think Howard Fineman wrote about this. This is one of these elections where endorsements seem to matter. And usually they don't. I mean, look at what happened with Barack Obama and Ted Kennedy. We'll see what happens next Tuesday. But it certainly did get Barack Obama a lot of attention and bring people out. You're also seeing, I think for, again, we're talking about Republicans. Schwarzenegger helps. Obviously, it's California on the 5th of February. And so having the governor always helps you in a state because governors are pretty powerful. They've got a lot of people who depend upon them who want to make them happy. So getting endorsements, which endorsements you get, matter more than just getting blank endorsements. Some of them have good PR value. You may get a good press release out. Some of them really can offer you substance on the ground, workers, money, fundraisers, that sort of thing.
And if I may add, in Florida, McCain getting the endorsement by Governor Crist and also by Mel Martinez helped him with the Cuban vote, and that put him over the top. So I do agree with Arnold Schwarzenegger endorsing McCain could help him out a lot.
All right. Well, Angela and Jamal, thanks so much.
Thank you for
Thank
having
you.
Us.
We've been speaking with Republican strategist and Fox News political analyst Angela McLaughlin and Democratic political strategist Jamal Simmons. He joined us from our NPR headquarters in Washington, D.C. This is News and Notes. I'm Farai Chidea. Anti-affirmative action activists are hoping to see a new measure added to November ballots in five states. The voter initiative is called Super Tuesday for Equality. It's the brainchild of former University of California Regent Ward Connerly. Connerly's led the charge in California and other states to ban the consideration of race and gender in educational admissions and hiring. He's now president of the American Civil Rights Institute in Sacramento, California. That's a nonprofit group dedicated in part to ending affirmative action nationwide, and he's with us now. Mr. Connerly, welcome.
I'm glad to be with you.
So your group has targeted five states, Colorado, Missouri, Arizona, Oklahoma, and Nebraska. Where do your efforts stand?
We are progressing quite well. We have turned in the signatures in Oklahoma. We are collecting signatures in all of the other states. And I fully expect that we will be on the ballots in all five of those states.
Are you pleased with what's shaken out afterwards? There's been criticism, particularly of educational issues in California and Michigan, and how a country that is as diverse as the United States will fare in the future after there have been a diminishment in enrollment of African Americans and some other groups in some of the public educational institutions. Give us a sense of how you feel your work is affecting America.
Well, it's important for one to recognize that there's not been any diminution in the access of individuals to getting an education. It is just factually incorrect that the number of, quote, minorities, close quote, who are able to go to college has been reduced as a result of our initiative. Yes, there has been some redistribution, if you will, of students to those institutions where they are academically competitive. The important thing is to recognize that there is an academic gap. It is a very serious one, and that gap needs to be closed, because whether by initiative or whether by court decision, anyone who's ever followed this issue knows that race preferences is living on borrowed time.
Last October, you were deposed by a pro-affirmative action group known as BAM. They're in court fighting the results of Proposition 2, otherwise known as the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative. We're going to talk with the national co-chair of BAM, Shanta Driver, in a few minutes, but here's what she told us earlier about what came from the seven-hour deposition with you.
First, that it was his intention in proposing Proposition 2 to drive Black and Latino students out of the University of Michigan and off of campuses all across this country, and two, that he knew the result of the passage of Proposition 2 would be to resegregate higher education, and that that is his aim and intent.
Is that an accurate parsing of your views?
Ms. Driver and Bam have been known before to lie and misrepresent, and this is in the true tradition of by any means necessary, and I guess that's why they're called by any means necessary. And lying is certainly one of the means that they're using. I do not believe that people should be treated differently on the basis of race. If you set a regulation or you set a law or you put into law the policies that you believe in, one should not go out and use a deposition to distort what you say. And we're going to be doing everything that we can to shed the light of truth on the despicable tactics of them, as evidenced by this misrepresentation.
There have been several articles, one of them most recently in Ms. Magazine, that ask whether or not you have an actual financial stake or financial interest in the work that you do, citing that the construction industry, among others, has been one of the supporters of your work. How would you respond to the idea that although your group is a nonprofit, you are someone who is employed in this work and that you are benefiting to a certain degree from the financially from your efforts?
It is not unusual for me to have made, prior to 1993, well over $2 million per year. To suggest that somehow I'm financially profiting for this is just wrong.
Now, speaking of opposition, it's a political year, and both Senators Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton on the Democratic side are firm supporters of affirmative action.
Why do you keep saying affirmative action when we're talking about race preferences? Are you somehow trying to mischaracterize this debate?
I think that the language has been quite in debate, and it's absolutely accurate that you can bring up your point of view and how language is used. But affirmative action is a term widely used by politicians and widely used by people who are talking about the issues that you bring up. So while I respect your ability to bring up your view on the language, I think that we're talking about the same issue. Is that incorrect to you?
Well, no, we're not, because affirmative action comes in many forms, some of which I support. If you're talking about using affirmative action to ensure that there is no discrimination, which is how affirmative action started, I support that kind of affirmative action. So I think it's very important that you be more precise in how you describe this issue.
Well, let's talk then very specifically. Barack Obama, Hillary Clinton supporting the use of race and gender in affirmative action programs. Are there any presidential candidates who have supported your point of view?
My understanding is that Mayor Giuliani supported my point of view. I believe that Senator McCain supports my point of view. Well, I don't know. I haven't asked any of the others. And I really am not terribly preoccupied with what their position might be.
Well, Mr. Connerly, thanks for your time.
Right, welcome.
Ward Connerly is the president of the American Civil Rights Institute in Sacramento, California. He joined us from his office. There are plenty of people lined up against Connerly's Super Tuesday for Equality. You heard a bit from Shanta Driver, the national co-chair of BAM, or By Any Means Necessary. It's a coalition defending affirmative action. Shanta, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for having me.
So we just heard Ward Connerly, and he strongly disagrees with your position. He says that people shouldn't be treated differently in hiring and education because of race, and that you've actually mischaracterized the deposition you did with him in October. How do you respond to that?
I think my characterization of the deposition was completely accurate. And I think what Mr. Connerly was saying was a complete non sequitur. The truth of the matter is, where affirmative action programs have been eliminated, like in the University of California system, there's been a tremendous drop in Black and Latino student enrollment in all the graduate law and medical programs and at UC Berkeley and UCLA. And I think it's just disingenuous and dishonest to say that Black and Latino students are now being matched with colleges that they're academically able to go to. The truth of the matter is, people like Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton, beneficiaries of affirmative action, would not have been at Harvard or at Yale had there not been those programs. And obviously, they were completely qualified to be there, as are all of the other Black and Latino and women students in prestigious elite higher education institutions in this nation.
You fought and you lost. I'm talking about the Michigan Civil Rights Initiative of 2006. Now we're talking about five more states. Really, what are you trying to do if these measures pass?
I think if they pass, then we're going to be filing lawsuits in every single one of the states where they've been passed, in Oklahoma, in Arizona, in Colorado, in Nebraska, in each and every one of those states. And very much like the march to the Supreme Court that was made by Thurgood Marshall nearly 50 years ago now to get Brown versus Board of Education, we're going to be going to the Supreme Court and saying, overturn the new Jim Crow. You can't have an America in which states decide to eliminate the only programs that have brought about successful integration of higher education and of every occupation in this nation.
Now, Ward Connerly said economic affirmative action was okay, so, you know, rich and poor, but not racial or gender. How do you feel about those distinctions?
I think that it's I think that there's something very misguided about that. If you're saying that the government can take action to try to bring about equality based on finances and economic status, it seems to me that given that racism and sexism still deform opportunity in this society, it makes no sense to stand against allowing the government and allowing the private sector to take action to try to bring about greater equality and equal opportunity.
Next week in Michigan, a federal district court judge is going to hear oral arguments against Prop 2. That judge could decide to throw out the proposition as unconstitutional, but you're actually hoping for a full trial. Why?
We are, because we think that we have to go to the Supreme Court with a full record in these cases. We think that it's extremely important to get at the question of what is of who has a preference in the society. And I think, as Ward Connerly himself admitted in our deposition, there are all kinds of preferences and privileges that white men have that still are not afforded to the whole society. And I think it's very important to get a trial record on that.
Well, Ms. Driver, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Shanta Driver is national co-chair of By Any Means Necessary, a coalition that defends affirmative action. And she joined us from her office in Detroit. All this month, our series, Great Expectations, focuses on people who've triumphed by overcoming adversity in their lives. Today, we'd like to take a look at the classroom. The U.S. Supreme Court's landmark decision, Brown v. Board of Education, was a huge triumph for black students in America. It signaled the end of legally segregated schools, and it helped give all kids legal access to a good education regardless of race. But that 1954 case grew out of five others that had been folded into a single unit. One of those cases was Briggs v. Elliott. It came out of Clarendon County, South Carolina. That's where Reverend Joseph Armstrong Delane helped a group of black parents with their demand for equal schools. Delane and then NAACP lawyer Thurgood Marshall turned that suit into a push for desegregated education. Joining me now to talk about the Briggs case is Nathaniel Briggs. His parents were the lead plaintiffs in the case. Also, Joseph Elliott, he's the grandson of Roderick Miles Elliott, who ran one of Clarendon County school boards and was the case's lead defendant, and Joseph Delane Jr., son of the late Reverend Delane. Gentlemen, thanks for coming on.
Thank you for inviting us.
So, Joseph Delane, I want to start with you. Your father played a major role in getting the case to court. How did Reverend Delane first get involved with the parents in Somerton, the town where he ministered?
My father ministered in the Clarendon County area and lived in Somerton. This was his home county. His personality was one that he was involved in activities outside of his church parish as much as he was in the church parish. So therefore, he had the confidence of the people there, particularly the African Americans. And he was very involved or concerned about the uplift in terms of their socioeconomic problems in that area.
Nathaniel, you grew up in Somerton. You went to school there. What were the schools like?
Well, let me explain it. I only went to the fifth grade there in Clarendon County. Due to Dad signing the petition, we moved away in 1960. But in that short time, it was blacks on one side of the town and the whites on the other side of the town. It was always separate there in town, also the school. The only time we came in contact with whites, either in the store or basically that's it. We never intermingled at all.
Now, when you say that you moved away due to signing the petition, were there threats? Why did you move away?
Well, when Dad and my mother signed the petition, they was threatened and their job was terminated. And he tried to make a living there in town as a farmer, but he couldn't get the proper price for his crop. So he eventually wound up give up the farm idea and moved to Miami to make a living and sent money back home to us. And that's when our father left us in South Carolina. And 2 years later, we wind up moving to Miami, Florida with him. When you're in this struggle and you couldn't get work, when you're poor, you just can't just up and move. So within 2 years, we moved to Miami with our father.
Do you ever or did your father ever regret the price your family had to pay?
Well, no, because he knew that he made the right decision. I personally didn't think that he knew all this stuff was going to happen to him. I'm quite sure he didn't want to leave his mother and his parents in South Carolina, nor leave his family in South Carolina. But that was the price that he paid. We moved around quite a bit in a short distance of time.
Joseph Elliott, your grandfather, is the late Roderick Miles Elliott of Briggs V. Elliott. Tell me a little bit about him and about his status in the community.
Well, he was a prominent figure, and white figure in Somerton, and he was chairman of the board of one of the, I think, 26 districts in Clarendon County, and he entertained the same opinions of almost all of the white Southerners of his day. He was a product of a societally imposed mindset, and I think that controlled his thinking. He did what was expected of him as chairman of the board.
When you have heard your family history passed down, what kind of impact did it make on your family specifically and perhaps other members of the white community to have to really consider what this meant in terms of potential integration?
When I was growing up, I was 14 when the decision was handed down, May 17, 1954. And I was, most whites were just oblivious to the disparities there, and we wore the proverbial blinders, and I guess we were just conditioned that way. You know, we saw some individual cases where blacks were mistreated, and we were sympathetic, and sometimes we just couldn't understand it. But we got over that because it was just a way of life. And once again, I guess we were very subtly conditioned to accept things the way they were at the time.
Well, gentlemen, we are going to go to a quick break. I'm going to come back and talk with you more about the landmark case Briggs v. Elliott and about the desegregation of America's schools. We're talking with Joseph Elliott, Joseph Delane, and Nathaniel Briggs. We'll be right back. I'm Farai Chidea, and this is News and Notes. We're continuing our look at a historic civil rights case, the final part of our series, Great Expectations. The historic Brown v. Board case that ended legal segregation was actually made up of five different cases from across the country. One of those came out of South Carolina. It was called Briggs v. Elliott. Today I'm speaking with people whose parents and grandparents were directly involved in that case. I'm talking to Nathaniel Briggs. His parents were the lead plaintiffs in the case. Also Joseph Elliott. He's the grandson of Roderick Miles Elliott, who ran one of Clarendon County school boards and was the case's lead defendant. And Joseph Delane Jr., son of the late Reverend Delane. Reverend Delane helped a group of black parents with their demands for equal schools. Gentlemen, welcome back.
Thank you.
I want to ask the three of you, starting with you, Joseph Elliott, how did whites in Somerton respond to desegregation once it came?
Well, they didn't really. In other words, they didn't comply with the ruling. There was very little integration. Well, I left Somerton in 1960 and returned in 1995, so I was away for 35 years. And I saw a lot of change in terms of, you know, level of communication and so on. But as far as the schools, they are fairly much like they were, and that's in the that card of shame, and they're just calling for minimally adequate, and they still have a long ways to go, I think.
You just mentioned the corridor of shame. I was in South Carolina last week and did a story about this group of poor rural schools that lie along Interstate 95. Now, some of the schools today are suing South Carolina for more resources. I spoke to a parent named Cynthia Thomas, and she's the school secretary at J.B. Martin Junior High. Here is how she described her school's poor condition.
I think it needs a lot of structural work. I think they put a lot of paint and different things over it. But when you go to the core of things, you can tell that the foundation of some things are just not stable, and it will not last for long.
Nathaniel, you don't live in South Carolina anymore, but you do go visit. Does this description sound a little bit like the black schools of the early 1950s?
Yes, because the schools, a lot of the schools, and especially in the poor communities, are still the same. It's like the case, it happened 50 years ago, we celebrated, and we're going to move on. But that same school district that brought the case, that changed America forever, is still poor.
Joseph Delane Jr., how do you make sense of what's going on in South Carolina, but also nationally? Many people have argued that America's schools are resegregating. From your point of view, knowing what you do, having the family history that you do, how do you make sense of what's going on in the U.S. today?
I don't know how to make sense of what's going on there, because the schools across the United States are resegregating just in the past few years. With regard to Clarendon County and Somerton, it takes more than just a school system to improve the school system. There's a complete societal change that has to be made, and this includes the economic and educational conditions of those people that already exist in the area. And that has not occurred.
This series that we've been doing all month is called Great Expectations, because despite some of the things that we're talking about right now that have highlighted the ongoing struggle for equality, this has been, this case has created change in America. What I would ask of you finally is, what have you taken away that is a lesson about perseverance or triumph even? Nathaniel, let me start with you from this case.
You will get involved with a problem, and you'll come to the realization that you can't turn around, because the cause is just, the cause is right. There's no turnaround when you get involved with a struggle.
Joseph Elliott, hearing what Nathaniel said, many people paid a price in how desegregation did or did not work. What comes out, despite that price, that sticks with you as a victory?
Well, you know, Somerton was demonized in the early days and really just victimized a lot of the whites by the press, and so they sort of, you know, just distanced themselves from the case. And what we tried to do at the 50th anniversary was to celebrate it and get the, you know, the total population together, and it just didn't work out because of the history there. A lot of people looked at it as a black victory in some of them, and it was a victory for America, and that's the way I look at it, and that's the way a lot of whites do look at it now, but not enough.
Joseph Delane Jr., what do you see coming out of this that has been positive?
If we look back, many of the changes that occurred after this were not in the schools, and they affected every American in this country. When we talk about the oppression that was there and the sensitivity to denial of citizens, that has changed. There was an attempt with the schools. However, I don't think that was successful in equalizing them. And I think there are other basic problems in this country that have to be overcome before we get equalization of educational opportunity in schools.
Well, gentlemen, I want to thank you for sharing your time and your stories with us.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
I spoke with Nathaniel Briggs. His parents, Harry and Liza Briggs, were the two lead plaintiffs in Briggs v. Elliott. That suit was combined with four others to create the historic Brown v. Board of Education case. Nathaniel Briggs is retired from the auto industry and lives in Teaneck, New Jersey. We also spoke with Joseph Elliott. He's the grandson of the late Roderick Miles Elliott, who chaired one of Clarendon County school boards and who also was a lead defendant in Briggs. Joseph Elliott is an adjunct lecturer in the history department at the University of South Carolina, Aiken. Also finally spoke with Joseph Delane Jr. He's the son of the late Reverend Joseph Delane. Mr. Delane is retired from the pharmaceutical industry and he lives in Charlotte, North Carolina. Time again for a look at the world of sports with our very own Tony Cox. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Farai.
Well, football fans are pointed towards Glendale, Arizona this week, huh?
Yeah, that's right. Something called Super Bowl 42. Have you ever been to a Super Bowl, Farai?
No, but I've had some really, really good chicken wings at the Super Bowl parties.
Well, I've covered a few, and I'll tell you, it is something to see. And in fact, that's where our man is this week. Of course, he is New York Times sports columnist Bill Roden. Hey, Bill.
We're great, Tony Cox. I'm doing wonderful, man. How are you doing?
Listen, man, I'm great. You have been in Arizona all week with all the hype and all the media who quite literally come from around the world to cover this extravaganza. Let me ask you this. Do you get a sense that there's much excitement about this Super Bowl? And here's why I ask, because this is the 42nd edition, but it hasn't always lived up to the hype. You know, there have been games that were good, but the last really exciting game, I think, was Super Bowl 34, when the Tennessee Titans and St. Louis Rams went down to the wire, and the Titans came within an arm's length of the goal line and winning that game as time ran out, but it hasn't been exciting since.
Well, you know, Tony, that game, even that game was exciting in retrospect. Going in, you know, there was Steve McNair and all that. But I got to tell you, Tony, there is, I have not been at a Super Bowl, I've covered maybe about 20 of them, that has had this level of expectation. And I think it's really going to be a great game because for the first time in a long time, you've got two teams with something really, really, really at stake. I mean, the Patriots have this 18-0 record at stake and the championship. That's historic. I think they're now admitting it, that they've come too far now to lose a game, and I think they feel a little bit of, you know, carrying the weight of history, that they've got this unblemished record. The Giants are just simply pro football's hottest team. They've come together at the perfect time. I think that on paper they've got everything it takes to beat New England. So, yeah, Tony, I think that there really is a level of expectation, because I think we feel, we journalists who write the first draft of history, feel that we are in the midst of history if New England could win this game. This has never been done before.
Let's talk about the quarterbacks for a moment, and the man who is simply the man right now, Tom Brady, of course, of the New England Patriots. No matter what happens on Sunday, Bill Roden, is he going to go down as one of the greatest quarterbacks in history?
I think the answer is yes, Tony. But, you know, we live in an environment now, man, that where no matter how great you think you are, all it takes is one loss, one misstep, and people almost forget what happened yesterday. He's got three Super Bowl championships. So I think it's safe to say that, yeah, but there's something about winning this game, completing an undefeated schedule in this competitive environment, winning a fourth championship, that I think will put him in that level of Montana, of you know, Bart Starr, of really, really a true legendary status.
And what about Eli Manning, the brother of perhaps the second most celebrated quarterback, Peyton Manning? Now, a win for him would be huge, even bigger than his big brother's Super Bowl victory of just a year ago. So if Eli and the Giants pull off this win, that opens the debate, doesn't it, on who's the greater athlete between Eli and big brother Peyton?
You know, Tony, you kind of touched on it. I mean, the reality is that Eli has gotten here a lot quicker than his brother. I mean, it's taken Eli four years to get to the Super Bowl. I mean, Peyton was almost, it seemed like a lifetime. And every year he lost to New England. He lost, oh, can he do it? Does he choke? Where his younger brother's got here 4 years. And I think that if he wins this quickly, I don't know if we'll put him at that stature of Peyton for two reasons. A, Peyton is much more he's much more gregarious. He's much more extroverted. He carries himself in a different way. Eli is very, very, very low-key, very self-assumed. I mean, he could be in your studio right now, and you might not even know it,
mm-hmm.
you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that if he wins, I think it's more of a team victory, and he'll be the first to say, this is about us. I think sometimes Peyton's success is kind of has been made more about him.
Let me ask you one last question about Randy Moss. We can't get away without talking about him because only a few years ago he was the problem child of the NFL, and now since he's been with the Patriots, things have changed, even though he hasn't dominated in the playoffs so far, and he has that domestic abuse case hanging over his head as well. A big game Sunday would help quiet his critics, wouldn't it?
Yeah, in a way. I mean, I think we have to be very careful, Tony, of separating what you do off the field and what you do on the field. You know what I'm saying? So I think that what the great thing about this year for Randy Moss, the football player, is many of us forgot how great a wide receiver, how dangerous a wide receiver that he was. He's in an environment where he feels enthused, he's excited, and I personally think that he could really have a game on Sunday that really reminds us how dangerous he really is.
Now, the Patriots are favored by 12 or 13 the last time I checked the spread. Is that the same, and who do you like?
Well, you know, I knew we were going to get to that point, Tony. And, you know, I really like the Giants. I'm going to give you a typical coach's answer. I really like the Giants. I think that they've got the perfect team to beat New England. And if it were any other team than the Patriots, or even the Patriots had lost two games, I would choose New York. But, man, I just cannot choose against and go against a team that is 18-0. I just, professionally, I just can't. it defies logic. What about you?
I understand. Yeah, my heart is with the New York Giants, but I don't know that they can win. But just so that we'll make it interesting, I'll take the Giants.
Okay.
And you can take the Patriots. And the winner buys dinner.
There you go.
I like lobster. Hey,
everybody's heard this too.
I like lobster.
Good.
Bill Roden, thank you very much, bro.
Hey, Tony, it's always a pleasure, man.
That was NPR's Tony Cox speaking with our regular sports commentator, William C. Roden. Roden is a sports columnist for the New York Times and author of Third and a Mile, The Trials and Triumphs of the Black Quarterback. It's Thursday and time to read your letters. Here to lend a hand is our producer and editor, Christopher Johnson. Hey, Christopher, what do you got?
More fire for our political coverage.
Uh-oh, time to duck.
Well, you might want to get low for this one. We got some notes about your talk last week with Illinois Senator Barack Obama. You asked the senator about reports that he'd attended a madrasa, or Islamic school, when he was a kid in Indonesia. Some media outlets have said those reports are false, and Senator Obama said, amen to that.
I went to a secular school in Indonesia, which is happens to be a country that is majority Muslim. And we're now seeing emails that are being distributed repeatedly as part of a smear campaign or political strategy, which insults not only me and my Christian faith, but also tries to stir up anti-Muslim sentiment.
John Lewis in San Francisco heard that interview, and he wrote us this. Imagine my utter disappointment when I heard Shadeya ask him about madrasas. How insulting. Leave that crap to CNN and Fox.
John, this is what we do. The news. We contextualize the quote, and a lot of folks got something from the question and the answer. But I will tell you this, Senator Obama got even hotter under the collar than you were. Also, Vladdy Brownswagger in Oakland said this about our music coverage. Please do your music features in other genres besides urban R&B, hip-hop, and gospel. There are many, many black people involved in many, many other genres of music, and try to venture outside of the U.S. So, Vladdy, we've stopped by Brazil, headed over to Benin, and we've got an interview coming up with avant jazz man Butch Morris.
And I've done a few stories on black punk.
But, hey, why don't you kick us some ideas? We're open. And on another cultural tip last week, while I was in South Carolina, I spoke with a man who's working hard to preserve the heritage of the Gullah people, descendants of enslaved Africans who've held on to their language and culture. Listener Karna Inman said, All of this South Carolina talk reignited my interest in the Gullah people. I very much enjoyed Farai's interview with Emory Campbell. I was pleasantly surprised to hear him recite in Gullah a few verses from the Lord's Prayer.
And lastly, Farai, here's a little more love for news and notes. Cheryl Field in Minneapolis says she loves listening to the show because it brings her a refreshing, insightful look at news. And Mary Stevens in St. Charles, Missouri says, News and Notes is my favorite on NPR. I just thought you'd like to know that a 53-year-old white woman from Middle America gets more out of your program than any other news program on radio or TV. Please keep up the great work.
Hey, Mary and Cheryl, thank you so much for giving us a shout. My mom will thank you, too.
That's it for letters, but please keep yours coming.
To write us, just log on to npr.org and click on Contact Us. Please be sure to tell us where you're writing from and how to pronounce your name. And as always, thanks, Christopher.
Anytime, Farai.
Rock, jazz, urban, classical, world, folk. Discover old and new favorites in a variety of genres at NPR's music website. That's at npr.org/music. Upon a broken guitar.